All right. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the fifth webinar in our series from AOSG this year. We're really delighted to have been doing these webinars throughout the year. We've had a really diverse range of topics that have come to be discussed. Today, we've got a particularly interesting one, which is going to be looking at how you might take Indigenous perspectives to help transform scholarly communication, taking a much wider approach, really, to the idea of what increasing access to communications is. And we're delighted that we have Lukman Hayes, who is the Scholarly Communications Team Leader in the Library at Auckland University of Technology. As we kick off, so that we have a hashtag on Twitter, if you'd like to tweet along, so please do. Please make sure that if you want to ask questions at the end, that you type them into the box so that we can come back to them. What I usually do is take the questions at the end and read them out. If you're desperate to talk yourself, please let me know and we'll try and facilitate that. Okay, so with that, I'm going to hand over to Lukman and we'll have the opportunity at the end to ask questions. As I say, if you've got questions that you're thinking about, please type them in and we will make sure that we get to them at the end. Thanks very much. I'll hand over to Lukman now.
Kia ora, thank you, Ginny. I'm just going to pull up my slides. Okay, kia ora koutou, tēnā koutou katoa, nō tāmaki makaurau ahau, he kaitiaki pukapuka, kei te wānanga o Aranui o tāmaki makaurau. Ko Lukman Hayes tōku ingoa, ka nui te mihi kia koutou katoa, nō reira, tēnā koutou katoa. So, hello everyone, what I basically just said there was, hi, my name's Lukman. I'm a librarian at AUT University Library, and I come from Auckland, or Tāmaki Makaurau. And yeah, pretty much hi to everybody. I just want to check that everybody can hear me okay, and if you haven't muted your mics, could you do so? That would be great. So here I am in Auckland. The weather outside is looking not too bad. It's been a bit grim. I don't know where you're listening from. We've had a few showers today and it's not too bad right now, but hopefully it won't affect this little talk. A little bit of a disclaimer. This talk is about Indigenous perspectives and how they might help us to transform our scholarly communications environment. I don't identify as Māori. I'm Te Iwi Pākehā, or non-Māori. My family came from Eastern Europe on my mother's side and from England and Ireland on my father's side. I'm getting quite a lot of voices from I'm just wondering if we could mute our microphones. Okay. Okay, so I'm a student of Te Reo. I'm learning the language, but I'm by no means an expert, and I'm just merely kind of interested in alternative worldviews, if you like, and how they might inform the work that we do. And so to get us started, I'll talk a little bit about the context behind Tūwhera. or the Horopaki. Tūwhera is an open access journal hosting service at AUT. And on the surface, the story is quite straightforward. We launched in 2016. It was the product of a feasibility study which came out of the library in 2014. And led to the creation of a scholarly communications team at the end of 2015. But this is also a story of change and growth, a kind of change that is iterative and evolutionary, and has inspired alternative ways, if you like, of looking at the work that we do, the environment in which we're working, and the kind of ethos that we want to model and strive towards. So as we've gone along, Tūwhera has developed a kind of wairua, which is a Māori word for spirit or ethos, a wairua of its own. And it's enabled us to consider academia, scholarly communication, and ourselves as a library and as a team through arguably less westernized lenses, such as through reference to an acknowledgement of indigenous knowledge paradigms. Another little disclaimer I should put in here, if on occasion I might get a little bit political and ranty, so that's should be noted as being my perspective on things rather than that of my employers. So in this talk, I'm going to discuss how we got set up, where we've got to, and in telling that story, I hope to be able to draw out some of the deeper learnings and how they might be useful as a counterpoint to our rather hierarchical, individualized attitude to knowledge. So, to say that we launched in 2016 with these two peer-reviewed journals, Pacific Journalism Review and Applied Finance Letters. And they were set up using, so give those of you who are interested a little bit of technical background, using Open Journal Systems, which is an open source platform developed by the Public Knowledge Project. And many of you will be familiar with OJS, I'm sure. It's used by thousands of universities worldwide for journal hosting or publishing. In Aotearoa, New Zealand, we have quite a few examples of sites. So Otago and Victoria are two places where you might find some OJS-style journals. And those are set up using what is now an older version of OJS, and a sort of out-of-the-box template and style that you get with that version. And so those of you who are familiar with OJS will know that until it recently launched a version 3, after many years of development, the standard journal site themes which were offered were left a lot to be desired in terms of usability and design. But through a bit of research, we found there were dedicated people out there who had done a bit more with OJS. So, and the great thing is with the community is that they make that work freely available for others to adapt and share. And so we did that very thing. This is from a journal coming out of the Mason Publishing Group, which is at George Mason University in the United States. And from that theme there for narrative and conflict, we were able to adapt and apply that to some of our first two journals. Our Applied Finance Letters, that was a journal which was sitting on this AUT host website here as a set of static PDFs without any indexing or shareability. And we were able to put that onto an OJS site, and there you can see the style has been adapted from that Mason site. So these early, I say earlier, only last year, these first two journals were really showed some of the benefits of open access. Obviously, for applied finance letters, it was all about visibility and opening up their scholarship to a global audience. And our second journal, Civic Journalism Review, was a kind of semi-open access journal for those of the readers who knew how to register on its site. But this was very much a journal with benefits for readers accessing it in parts of the world with poor access to research, particularly in the South Pacific and parts of the Asia Pacific. So in those resource poor areas, having something open access and freely available is obviously advantageous and one of the key benefits of open access. So Pacific Journalism Review, which has been going for something like 23 years now. It's been great to have them with us. In addition to obviously hosting the journals, we wanted to have a shop front for our journals, or a landing page, if you like. And so we looked around at what was out there and took inspiration and ideas from those. And I think it would have been tempting, given our own resource constraints, to create a simple page of links to our journals and bury it somewhere on our existing library website. But we were, at this time, forming a unique identity, and we wanted something which reflected that. And perhaps because we were thinking about makerspaces at the time, we came across this site, which is from a MakerBus, an American site again. And we felt that some of the design ideas in that page, or those pages, were really resonated some of the ideas that we were tapping into around warmth and openness and clean design. And we wanted our landing page to reflect that open concept. So we took inspiration from this. And so from there you get two fella similar structure. And around this time, we were also reflecting on the name for the service, and it struck us that leading with a Maori name might be a small way to acknowledge or honour the treaty. Now, I guess I need to explain for those of you who aren't familiar with New Zealand's history. The Treaty of Waitangi is an important document for the population here. It has two versions, Te Tiriti, the Maori version, might be argued, and Treaty of Waitangi, which is the one that will turn up in just about every institutional document and employment document that you find, but which raises the question very often, what actually does it mean when it sits in these institutional documents? And this is a document, the treaty is obviously around settlement between Maori and the European settlers to the country. So we felt this was one way of at least not just acknowledging, but perhaps bringing to life some of the ideas within that treaty or that document. And in doing so, and perhaps in acknowledging that, we might consider ourselves in a way to be more inclusive and perhaps even more bicultural in the way in which we were working. Certainly what we were doing felt more Oceanian. So the word tūwhera, which just means be open or opening, seemed to fit well and to encompass that concept, which lay at the heart of what we wanted to do with AUT edited scholarship. When we chose the name, we actually consulted with Maori members of academic staff here, and when we launched the service, we did so with strong Maori flavour and tikanga, correct way of doing things. So karakia, or blessings, and waiata, or song, came into what we did. So this year, moving on, we launched. We've added three more titles this year. This one you see on the screen, Te Kaharoa, was our first using the new OJS 3 version, And that was back in April that we launched that. So again, this is actually not a typical OJS theme. This is not what you get when you install the software. This is actually, this design was actually inspired by these people coming up. This is a Finnish publishing organization or group, the Finnish Science Journals Online. And so the work that they'd done with OJS 3, they made freely available. They made it open source. And we were able to access that through the OJS publishers or creators, PKP. So when we consider this kind of sharing, we might think of the open source community, if you like, in terms of whanaunatanga, which is a Maori concept with a key word at its heart, which is whānau or family. So obviously within the open source community, there is this sense of reciprocity and sharing and mutual benefit, and through that, developing and growing. So to show you a little bit more detail, this is one of the sites from that Finnish publishing group, and from that we get our template. This is another of our new sites, Te Whārenga. So Te Whārenga, a peer-reviewed journal, and Public Health, Pacific Health rather, oops, it's not showing up, never mind. They launched in July. And as you can see from some of the titles that we've got listed there, the platform really has taken on this sort of Pacific feel, particularly with journals leading with Maori titles. Pacific Journalism Review there has recently also added a Maori name to its title. It's going to be known as Te Kuakua, which is a name for a Maori name for mutton bird. If we go back to 2016, around Open Access Week, we had some conversations and discussions with academics here, particularly around a panel discussion that was held about how new publication types might emerge and be hosted and supported. And so we have those now coming into the fold with Tufera, and those new publications are there to highlight some new and emerging research. And so this led us really to think of Tufera as creating a kind of incubator space, so guiding and advising the fledgling publications alongside those more established, wiser cousins, as it were. So in a sense, having a kind of whānau or family role. So some of that, those publications might be targeted at practitioners in the community and in industry, while others offer unique research content, unique to the Pacific, which is not being published elsewhere, and which hasn't necessarily followed traditional academic publishing route, peer-reviewed style up to this point. But the key point here is that there is a desire to communicate research with the wider community, not just within the confines of the academy. So what has drawn that interest is this acknowledgement that sharing research in this way has clear and tangible benefits for the researchers involved, as well as the potential for attracting future funding and collaboration. While for us, it's very much a desire to share and to support. Pacific Health, which I was referring to earlier, this is a brand new peer-reviewed journal setting itself up on our site. They have no issues there to show. They're just inviting submissions from this point. And Hospitality Insights, on the other hand, is the first of our lay summary publications. So this one will be aimed directly at that community outside of the academy and inviting that conversation. the screen grab there is actually just from our test site. That one's not live yet. will be shortly, we hope. Working with the editors on both of these titles can be seen in terms of these concepts that you see on the screen here. Afinatia and Manaakitanga. Both of those terms, it should be said, are perhaps much broader than those definitions that have been placed there. They can be interpreted and used in a number of different contexts. But we feel certainly this is the way we've interpreted the way in which we're relating to our researchers as taking on those values. So we have a relationship with them which has this reciprocal feeling. Hospitality Insights, for example, has offered us quite a few cakes over the months that we've been working with them. I've yet to see them yet. So a lot of the thinking around the influence of Māori concepts and values stem from that word, tupara. I think there is a significance in the fact that the word, like many of in the Māori language, has multiple interpretations and contexts. It signifies an opening up, if you will, of ideas and possibilities. As a wider team, this has impacted on how we carry out and think about our work in terms of shared values, such as Ubuntu, which can be interpreted to mean I am because we are, or a person is a person through other people. This is an African concept. And it's one that has similarities to the Māori concept of mana tangata, which is to be a person is not to stand alone, but to be one with one's people, which is also interpreted as meaning empowerment. So for me, this raises the question, might such a philosophical reassessment of this largely individualistic, meritocratic, if you like, and those values and motivations that currently drive academic output and its assessment, might that reassessment help to shape a sustainable and culturally relevant, holistic, and possibly even a communitarian scholarly landscape? In the last webinar, you heard Mandy Henk and Narita Kortamas talk about the role of power in the systems which we operate in. And I would add to that, we need to reconsider the knowledge economy as it's become in terms of colonialism as well as capitalism. Our understanding of knowledge creation, growth, and dissemination is dominated by institutions and corporations which are motivated by profit and obsessed with a perceived return on investment. These are an extension, it could be argued, of the plundering methods of knowledge and cultural accumulation of their imperial predecessors or ancestors. If we consider this phrase on the screen right now, mā tauranga Māori is loosely interpreted as meaning Māori knowledge. And to use to look at that definition for just a moment, it can be understood through a number of different elements. So whakapapa or genealogy, you can see the sort of layering of ideas and passing on through generations of thought and development. Through kōrero or discussion and conversation and how that moves things forward and outwards. Whakatauki or proverbs, wherein knowledge and wisdom might lie and be interpreted or reinterpreted, and waiata in a similar sort of way. And through those concepts, you have this passing on and layering of stories, wisdom, and narratives. And if we consider that, and now consider how we currently share knowledge that we contribute to, we might ask whether the knowledge does reside with the individual, as we're made to believe, or whether it belongs to the wider community, and in which case, who are we really doing this for? Is it for ourselves or for the wider benefit of society? In the blog, if you had a chance to read it, I referred to Chris Cormack's talk at Open Source, Open Society on Mirai-based consensus building, where Whakatauki are a source of better understanding and forming collaborative approaches to learning. These and other ideas have the potential, I believe, to be transformational if we're willing to consider a more collectivist, community-based worldview. As things stand, the mentality and the structure of the system in which we work are antithetical to this. So ultimately, this is a political as well as a philosophical question. That's if we are willing to engage with it. Now, some of the values and concepts that we as a team have adopted have actually made their way into our library strategic document. One outcome we're hopeful of is that our university responds to the calls we're making and the initiatives that we're championing around open access and develops a policy to match. In terms of our work, our thinking now is that TUFERA encompasses openness at AUT. Therefore, it represents an umbrella or an overarching vision that can incorporate a range and a diversity of knowledge sets. So when we relaunch, if that's the word we want to use, in, I hope, October, that's the aim, we propose to bring all of our open collections under the one whare or house as a statement that knowledge is a communication. It's a reciprocal kōrero, or conversation, with our communities in the spirit of ako, which is a reciprocal word in Māori meaning both learning and teaching. So that's all I have to say, and just to read you out the slide, obviously all of our open access collections include at the moment peer-reviewed journals and those things that we have out on our institutional repository, research outputs and theses and so on. But we propose to include monographs and the lay summaries that you saw a little sneak peek of. And who knows what might happen in the near future. We may be able to host student journals, and if miracles happen, we might be a place for open data as well. So that's all from me for now. I'm open to any questions you might have and a discussion. I simply lost the text box though.
Great, thank you, Lukman. That was tremendous, really fascinating talk. And I think it kind of encompasses what a lot of us would like to be thinking about more on a day-to-day basis rather than this sort of technical business around open access. And I think it's really important to be reminded of the bigger picture. So thank you for that. And I feel like I've got a much better grounding of Mary than I had at the beginning of the last time I heard that. So thank you. I'm going to open this up for questions. If you do want to talk, I would suggest that probably the easiest thing is just to type the box and I'll unmute you because everybody's muted at the moment. I'm going to kick off with a couple of questions as well. And also, we'll, if there's anything else that people have brought up on Twitter, we'll also follow there as well. We've got Sam Searle at Griffith. Sam, I'm going to unmute you. Do you want to ask your question? Or if not, I can just read it out for you. I'll unmute you just now. Hi, Sam. Okay, we might not be able to work with the technology. I'll read out the question and then Lukman, if you want to respond. So Sam's question was, first of all, thanks for the great talk. And then wondering if you could talk about staffing, the funding model, how this is being done at AUT. I think a lot of people have got an interest in that.
Yeah, sure. So staffing wise, we're a really small team. Scholarly communications team comprises myself, Donna and Rudy. Rudy is a repository administrator, and Donna was working between the repository and Elements, but her job has been sort of reshaped to be more of an OJS assistant, if you like, and more directly involved with publishing and less with the Elements work. So those, we between the three of us, we provide the user support. The wider digital services team, of which we're a part, includes people like Jackie and Craig, who provide a lot of technical support to us and have done the work around the look and feel of the sites, as well as the design of the landing page. All of the hosting and the server side stuff is supported through AUT's ITS. So when this was a project, so when the we got funding for a project to set this up, basically, and that funding enabled us to get support from our IT department here to provide the servers for all of the instances that we have of OJS. And that's pretty much how we run it. It's pretty small. Funding beyond that project, I'm not sort of privy to how that is worked out, but basically we're absorbing the cost as a library. We our journal editors aren't charged anything, and likewise we insist that they don't pass any charges on to the authors that publish with them.
Great, thank you. That's really useful to know. And I think that there's quite a few universities that might be thinking of doing similar things or are doing similar things. So this issue around sustainability and funding is always a question. I've got Tracy Creer here from QUT. I'm just going to pass over to her to follow up.
Hi, Lukman. Thank you so much for the webinar. I guess our issue at QUT is we have 5 open access publications, and it's literally taken us around 8 years to come together as a group and, I guess, engage with sectors. In terms of sustainability, I know it's early days for your activity, but is there any buy-in from other parts of the institution, or is it essentially a library-driven activity?
Sustainability is a big question, and I think to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of any other parts of the university buying into this as such. There is a general support of what we're trying to do. Strategically, though, the library has stated quite clearly that this is a priority, and this is an initiative which they're going to continue to support, because openness and open access are quite core to where we see the library going. So that whether there is a broader question perhaps around what how we support open access in institutions nationally, regionally, globally, that's a bigger question I think needs to be asked. Perhaps there are more creative ways of looking at sustainability and support, so that it's not just down to the individual institutions to support it, so that, you know, that leads to in the same way that something like Knowledge Unlatched works, you know, you have a lot of buy-in from a lot of different people ensuring its sustainability. But I don't know if that answers your question, but really it's a sort of no and I don't know and perhaps.
If I could just sort of comment on that and then another couple of questions. One is that I think that this is part of the bigger picture of open access to be part of a wider ecosystem. It's not just that we're thinking about transferring things from subscription to open access journals and we sort of translate exactly the same model, as it were, just with a different model of dissemination. I think it's very important that we think about the wider infrastructure and wider ecosystem. And I think that's what you're demonstrating here, is that this is a possibility for doing that. So I really like the model of building it at individual university. I'm going to just go on. So the first one is from Mark Cooper, also at QUT. He's got a question about peer review. Do the journals use? Are the journals also sort of following the open idea for peer review?
The peer review journals we have are run fairly traditionally. They have the most of them anyway have a blind peer review process in the traditional sense. There's no sign of any open peer review occurring as yet. That would be quite an interesting development. In terms of how they do it, it's pretty much the domain of the editors. We don't really get involved with that, although we've tried to guide them along the lines of the more clearly you state your peer review guidelines, the easier it is to for your journal to gain better kudos in terms of the top directories and indexing services and so on. But yeah, certainly the more established journals have the very traditional double blind peer review process in place. The smaller ones and the ones which are emerging are perhaps relying more on general review rather than blind peer review. But it is very much down to the editors and the editorial boards on those publications to work that out.
Great, thank you. I think that's interesting. I mean, one of the things that we have seen, certainly from my experience in peer review, is that often, particularly more in the social sciences, which I guess is where most of your journals are, there is less of an interest in open peer review at this point. It's coming, but it's not something that a lot of academics feel comfortable with.
Yeah, and we do have an advisory group which we set up initially as part of the project, and then was relaunched with when we became business as usual. And a member of that advisory group is a former, I believe, plus one editor. So he's open and has, you know, insight into how that will work. So who knows where we can go with this.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm going to go on to the next question. So this is from Julia Hickey. And her question is she's interested in why the journal titles that you have were chosen, whether they were particular areas of research strength at AUT, and whether there are particular academics that you're relying on to drive the content, etc. And obviously that can be a challenge if you're relying on just specific individuals.
Yeah, I think it's been fairly organic. They've come to us when they were ready, really, and when they found out about us. Pacific Journalism Review, the editor of that, David Roby, was one of the first people to approach the library about this idea. And so it went from there. We, as a project team, a couple of years ago, a year and a half ago, I suppose, did our own scan of all the journals being edited within the university, and we started to approach editors that way. There wasn't any sort of scientific reasoning behind how they came to be hosted by us. And I don't know if I'm answering your question correctly. I just thought, is this what you mean? But generally, editors have come to us when they've learned more about us, either through events or just general publicity or word of mouth. And we've worked in their schedule into how we can fit them in.
Okay, great. I think that's probably true of a lot of universities, is that you do end up with, you have the journals that people bring to you rather than necessarily going out and commissioning. But it is an interest, I think, that at some point there will be gaps that will have to be addressed within the open publishing landscape. And I wonder if there needs to be some coordination around that, perhaps. I've just got a follow-up from Otago where they're saying that's what your experience is, what's matched what's happened there. Organically, you just end up hosting journals that are available. That would be the same at QUT, I would guess. Okay, great. Could I just ask one thing that I was really interested in? How you, obviously, dissemination is really important to what you're doing with journals. And I wonder how what your use of social media and other ways of disseminating outside of the journal has been, what your experience has been there, and how successful you feel like you've got, how successful you've been of taking the journals out beyond the academic community.
I think it's really hard to measure that, and although we've started to track their usage, it's really early days, and so you can't, I don't think it's fair to look at any real trends as yet. Yes, we have a Twitter account, and yes, we post on behalf of the journals, both in terms of new issues and interesting articles, and try and increase the visibility that way. And that's backed up by our library social media as well. So we have that platform there. Whether that's helping to reach new audiences, I think it's really, really hard to say at this stage. I mean, it really has only been a year. So I'm not sure. I think the journals themselves are very happy with what's occurred so far in terms of increasing their visibility and use. I think it would be interesting to see how some of the new ones that are coming on with us, especially the ones who are just getting started, what the impact is in terms of how they link with their communities and their industry, because that's their aim. So it'll be interesting to watch that. But yeah, I can't really say how much we've increased, because it's just possibly too early to say.
Okay, no, that's great, thank you. And then I get related also to that is how successful you feel the journals have been at attracting authors from outside of the sort of the immediate community that launched them. Because obviously that's a key part of long-term sustainability.
Yeah, again, I don't know whether I can answer that question. I think none of the editors have come to us and said, this has been great, we've got a completely different set of contributors now. But then they haven't not said that either. So it's impossible to really know that without sort of going back to all of our editors and getting a sort of report back on whether this has increased their or diversified their contributor base. It's been a bit of, I think for some of the established journals, it has been quite a big learning curve just using a system to have contributions and submissions. A lot of their, not only their editors, but their contributors are used to just emailing in their copy and having a system of to-ing and fro-ing between email, which, as we know, is really messy. And that's the whole point of having an all-in-one system where you can just manage the whole process. You know, in this year, a lot of it has been around supporting those journals and their contributors in being able to use the system efficiently. For some of them, you know, they don't really know how to log into something. You know, they might lose their password. It's as simple as that. There's a lot of, you know, digital literacy to be overcome before we can even think about how much this benefits a new set of contributors or attracts a new set of contributors.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point, actually. And one of the advantages of using Node.js is that because it does have, it is used, you know, so much elsewhere around the world, you know, you hope that at some point the academic might actually have come into contact with it elsewhere. So, you know, you might have some familiarity with the technology from elsewhere and not necessarily a new one that you're coming to. We used to find that with journals that I've worked on is you build a new system. You know, however shiny and new it is, if it's not something that people are easily able to get their head around, it does become a barrier to submission. That's a real problem, I think. So I think that OJS is a good example of being able to get knowledge, as it were.
Well, the new version is a lot more user-friendly, it has to be said.
Yes, that's true. It wasn't that user-friendly to start with. Okay, we've got a question from UTS. Oh yes, so actually that is from, it's about the difference between working with OJS 3 over OJS 2. So the two different, the upgrade of the version. Do you think that's made a special difference to how your editors have interacted with the system, having an upgrade?
So our two initial journals are still on 2.4. And the other three all launched with OJS 3. We're ready to upgrade the first two journals, but unfortunately one of our editors has gone and broken his leg in two or three places. So he's all laid up and unable to come and train with us or anything like that. So we're holding that back for now. So we've not really been able to work through the challenge of an upgraded site with them. But for the others, they've been absolutely fine. They've moved from, well, with the criminal law journal, that was very much a single PDF journal sitting on a website. So having it on a system is obviously quite novel, but the editor there is quite used to using the OJS system, although he has used 2.4 quite a bit. So he seemed, after some trainings, he seemed to be completely fine with the new system. There is also, you've got to take into consideration the degree to which the editors will use the system. Sometimes the editor will want to do the process from submission through review to publication, the whole thing on OJS. Others will take a shortcut, if you like, and so we have to balance those needs, and that might just be receiving submissions, going somewhere else to put the whole thing together, and then going back to OJS to upload it.
Okay, great, thank you. I think we're coming to the end of the time. I'm just going to ask one more question, and then I'll wrap up. If anyone's got any last minute questions, do put them in the text box. So slightly, I guess, where would you like to see this in 5 years' time? Do you see that this is going to, do you have a sort of vision of how many journals you might be hosting, or do you think it's going to be diversifying into content? You've already talked about some different types. I'd be interested to see what.
Yeah, I mean, 5 years, I have no idea, but when we did our initial scan, there were about 20 or so journals being edited here at AUT. It would be great if they all came along with us, but I'm not sure we've got the capacity for that. We'll just have to take each step as it comes and grow incrementally and iteratively. I think that's the only way we can look at it, really, and that seems to work really well for us as well. I mean, we do things in a fairly folksy sort of way here. We kind of and when you're working within certain constraints, that's really the only way to do it, being realistic. But whether we're able to use this this concept, not necessarily the platform, but whether we're able to use the concept and as a way of housing data sets, that would be interesting. We've got to work with other developments going on in our university around that and see what comes out of that. But really our thrust is openness. So if there is capacity for making any knowledge-related collection open, then we should be thinking about how we can create initiatives to support that and to share, describe, publish, etc.
Great, thank you. Okay, well, thank you again for a tremendous talk. I learned a lot, and I feel like it's a really important perspective. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Just a reminder to everyone, we'll host the recording and the slides on the AOSG website, so keep an eye out for that, where we've got all the webinars from this year. We have a few more lined up for the rest of the year, and there'll be some notices coming out about that shortly. And also, I guess, really, if anyone has an interest in talking to one of these webinars, do please drop us a note, and we'd be very happy to hear from you. So thank you again to Luqman, and we'll look forward to seeing everybody again next month.